We are in the chapter of the book called The True Yoga, chapter 6 of the Gita, starting with stanza 7. 6-7. The tranquil sage, who has conquered the lower egoic self, abides ever in the supreme self. He views with equanimity all the dualities, cold and heat, pleasure and pain, praise and blame. 6-8. That yogi who is blissfully absorbed in the wisdom of the self is known as being unshakably united to spirit, unchangeable, the controller of his senses. He views with equal mind a clod of earth, a stone, and a bar of gold. 6-9. He is a supreme yogi who gazes equally upon patrons, friends, enemies, strangers, peacemakers, those who cause trouble, relatives, the virtuous, and the ungodly. 6-10. Free from the hopes engendered by desire and untouched by any craving for possession, the waves of feeling in his heart controlled by yoga concentration, the yogi retiring alone to a quiet place should try to unite his little self with the Supreme Self. 6-11. The yogi should have a firm, clean seat, neither too high nor too low. He should cover his seat with kusha grass first, then cover that with a deer or tiger skin, and then place upon that a wool and or a silk cloth. 6-12. Seated firmly there with one-pointed concentration of the mind and neither roaming mentally nor reacting to sense stimuli, let him seek self-purification by yoga practice using the techniques prescribed by his guru. 6-13. Holding the spine, neck, and head firmly erect and motionless, let the yogi focus his gaze at the starting point of the nose, nasikagram, between the two eyebrows, and let him not gaze elsewhere, but keep his gaze calmly one-pointed. 6-14, serene and fearless, steadfast in his vow of brahmacharya, sexual control, his mind controlled and his attention centered in me, the seated yogi should meditate on me as the ultimate goal of all striving. 6-15. The self-governed yogi, his mind fully controlled, attains the peace of supreme nirvana, the state of individual extinction in union with the spirit. These are beautiful verses. Is it possible to turn off or down the heat? Are you all warm enough or not? Is the heat on?
It's on.
Should we turn it down?
No, it's fine.
It's fine? Okay. It just does what it does. It's not controllable at all times. Is that better?
That's better.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. What I was trying to say is it too warm in here? Was that a clear question or not? Well, I can't tell because once I start talking, a lot of heat runs through me, so I begin to think it's really warm. So that's why I was inquiring. It was an inquiry.
I don't want it any warmer.
Do we want it? Okay. Is it fine? Okay, just wanted to know. Let's start. There's quite a few verses in the Gita that sound similar to this one, in which there are these long lists of opposites and this description about how we're all just so calmly indifferent to all of them. And how the meditating yogi, the great sage, the one united with wisdom, the pure of heart, the one filled with devotion. And then it just lists out all of these realities in life that would cause us to vacillate. And then it describes how the yogi, for one reason or another, is utterly unmoved in his perception of reality. No matter how much these things oscillate around him, he never loses his one-pointed concentration. Now, it's a very odd teaching when you really think about it, especially when you think about it from the outside, because everybody thinks about life in terms of having things happen that energize you. I mean, that's just natural. We're not talking about being blank and dull. Edwin and I were just having a discussion. I gave a class at East West last Friday, and the very last question virtually that was asked was about making your mind blank in meditation. And I answered somewhat quickly, because it was sort of at the end of the evening, about you can't make your mind blank, and that's not really what you do when you meditate. You calm your thoughts by uplifted concentration on something that transcends your thoughts. You don't just go into a stupor. I know going into a stupor is not something that any of us enjoy, and I think I have too much Gemini in my horoscope to have it happen too often. But there are times when you just realize that you have blanked out. Isn't that true? That you're just sort of, you're somewhere and you don't really know how you got there. You know, I have a little mantra sometimes, where am I and what am I doing here? You know, just like, I mean that mainly, like if I find myself in the kitchen and I was in my office the last time I remembered, like, why did I come downstairs? Or vice versa, why did I come up to my office? And just sometimes that'll happen, and it isn't because we're absent-minded. That's a different kind of reality where you're thinking hard about something and then you sort of lose track of what's happening. But there's this other kind of blankness, which is not an uplifting, not a happy state of mind, not a transcendental one. That doesn't make you joyous at all. There are many people who live a great deal of their life in a state of blankness. Somebody gave me a questionnaire, administered to me a questionnaire that was supposed to, she was doing some kind of a doctorate thesis somewhere, and it was about being, whether you were intuitive or what would be the opposite, rational, reasonable, whether you went by my reason or intuition, I can't really recall. But among things they tested was, in various ways, they asked you how many times you just wake up and realize you've been nowhere. I recall that it's not only not wholesome to meditate with the concept of blanking your mind, which people do teach, which is to say without having a point of dynamic upward-moving focus, it's actually dangerous. That's one of the few things that you can actually do in meditation that's dangerous, because a blank mind invites somebody else to come in and use it. And there is such a thing as disincarnate entities who are looking for bodies that they can influence. They hang around places where people drink alcohol and take drugs a lot, too, because in those circumstances, people have disengaged from their own minds, and they don't, the normal checks and balances that keep another a jiva from crowding in are put aside. And sometimes people even deliberately channel other entities and deliberately put themselves aside, which, spiritually speaking, and I know that there are people who say they do that or feel that they're doing that and consider it to be a positive thing, spiritually speaking, it's extremely unwholesome. As Swamiji put it, because not only do you have the whole enormous complex grid of your own subconscious mind, but then you have the whole grid of someone else's subconscious mind put on top of yours, and it can literally make you crazy. It's just really not the way high teachings are done. You just don't let somebody else use your body. It hurt my heart enormously. There was a person, I don't even know if she's still functioning. She was very popular for a time, and hers seemed to be a genuine case of channeling another entity. She just would go away, and then someone else would come in and use her body and would channel it and say all these self-evident but otherwise exciting things for people about love and so on. And she was doing this for years and years, and she just made this poignant remark that because, see, everything exciting happened when she wasn't there, when this other entity took over and all these big, you know, events would happen. But she said herself, I'm simply not present for a great deal of my life. And the effect of it on her was becoming more and more anguishing, because there would just be long periods of time when she would go unconscious and someone else would take your body over. Terrible. Now, I'm spending a little bit of time on this partly because Edwin just brought it up, but also it's a question people ask. Because they'll... Yes, Marilyn? It's a very good question. Question was, what about Edgar Cayce? Because when he would go into his trance state, he would have no recollection of being in that trance state. So he would come out of it, and he was called the sleeping prophet for that reason. As Edgar Cayce, he didn't know what he said when he was in those trance states. There was never any evidence that he was possessed, however. And when you read about his life, you realize that he was by no means an ordinary man. He had a very pure and selfless nature. He never profited from anything that happened. He was very devoted to God and a real devoted Christian. So you could sort of see in his life the kind of purity of heart that could enable him to function in that way, whereas this particular channel that I was thinking of profited enormously from the things that happened, became very, this whole huge empire built up around the channeled entity, and the person herself did not seem to be a person of particularly notably refined character. Except for that, it's true, Cayce was seemingly unaware. He would go into some other state that his ego couldn't recollect. Swamiji made a very interesting statement once. Well, he's made it since then, but in other contexts. But he talked about this. There was another well-known spiritual teacher, a very sweet and humble man, who came to visit Swamiji and asked Swamiji, the reason I'm not saying the man's name is because it was a sort of a moment that I witnessed that I probably shouldn't have been there. But the man said to Swamiji in a very please help me way, he said, sometimes my devotees, and he put himself forward as a guru, sometimes my devotees have dreams of me in which I give them advice, he said, but I have no awareness of it. You know, is that real? What's happening? And Swami answered him in several ways. He didn't at that time give the answer he gave me when I asked him a similar question. When I asked him a similar question, well, he did answer, but not so succinctly. He answered it perfectly in this way. He said, the superconsciousness never sleeps. It's only the brain that goes to sleep. And the superconscious self, what need would it have for sleep? Because it's not a physical entity, where would fatigue come from? So even though the brain may go asleep, that doesn't mean that the soul nature isn't still active. And sometimes the memory of what we do in our sleep on a higher level stays with us, and sometimes we're simply unaware of it. Then Swamiji went on to say that to a certain extent what happens as you advance spiritually is the barrier between your superconscious self and your ego self thins, and that you become more conscious of what your superconscious self is doing. Even specifically in things like that, like helping people with your superconscious when your conscious mind is not connected to doing it, you become more aware of that superconscious dimension of your own nature. Maybe in Edgar Cayce's situation, it was sort of like that. It was like his superconscious was acting in a certain way, but there was a veil between that and his ego's knowledge of what he was doing. And then Swami talked just about, in some completely unrelated place, he talked about his sense of how that the veil of ego was getting thinner, and he was becoming aware of a certain vastness of his own consciousness that he had not previously been aware of. And it wasn't even as if that vastness was being created. Rather, his awareness of it was expanding. Isn't it just a very interesting way to think about it? And that's the truth of all our natures, because we all live on the superconscious level, especially us. And us meaning people who meditate, who are devoted to Master, who have a very high aspiration to really live in that reality. We sort of function on this one, but at the same time, a tremendous amount is happening on dimensions that we can't actually see. A lot of work is being done, so to speak. And when we die, we merge more into that. And of course, when we become realized, we merge into it completely. Does that make sense? Are there any questions on that? Well, what I was wanting to make very clear about these distinctions is because people will often ask you about this, because yoga has this reputation of repudiating desires, repudiating the ego, repudiating all the things that everybody else thinks they want, and want a lot. I was talking to an individual on the phone who said, you know, I have so many interests. How can I really be serious on this path? I'm interested in so many things. I'm interested in music. I'm interested in art. I want to travel. I want to do this. And yet he had this feeling like he either had to choose between doing all those things or being on this path, which is an easy impression to get. And I was trying to explain to him, no, you just have to do them with an attitude of transcending the ego instead of increasing its hold over you. But the karmic force of those actions, that's what the Gita's been talking about a lot. You can't do nothing. You're going to have to act anyway. It's just a question of whether or not your actions reinforce or weaken the power of the ego over you. So still we come to these thoughts where all the spice in life is seemingly denied us. I mean, how many people will tell you, but if you don't suffer, if you don't have angst, if you don't have disappointment, how will you ever have joy? It's a sort of intellectual game to say that, because when they're in the angst and the disappointment and all of that, they're not enjoying it, and they don't really enjoy the happiness more for the suffering. The suffering is just a big bummer that just causes them to cling all the harder. It's a false argument that isn't really based on common sense. You don't need to have misery in order to have joy. You can just have joy. But the fact is, we do have misery. And the fact is that sometimes the way people enjoy is they enjoy in such an outward way, with such a push to make that enjoyment last, that they themselves can feel the instability of it. Do you know what I mean? It's just inherent in it. That's what you see. It's so, I've spent so much of my life in an ashram now. I'm really beginning to feel slightly, the word years ago when Swami, he was years ago when he was a lecturer in SRF as a monk, and he referred to popular music as boogie-woogie, and afterwards someone told him about rock and roll, which he'd never heard of. Isn't boogie-woogie a ridiculous word? Language is just so odd. You just say the word like boogie-woogie, which isn't really a word anyway. Somebody just made it up.
Well, what are we ignorant of? With all kinds of stuff going on out there we don't know
about. Exactly. I was about to comment on that. As soon as we are restored, we will go on. I was just editorializing about, I don't even know what boogie-woogie was. Oh, the boogie-woogie bugle boy of Company B, right. We all know that one. And when he spoke to his cousin about, just told her about that, she said, she called him Donald. Oh, Donald, you must be careful, you'll become quaint. That's the word she used, which is sort of, it's been a long-standing joke since then, whenever one or another of us reveals ourselves to be totally ignorant of something that everybody else on the planet knows. We accuse ourselves or the other of becoming quaint. Well, I can see my reality becoming quaint. I know that I talked on Sunday and I have been enjoying it lately. I've just accepted the fact that I'm old. Swami very, very proudly and consistently announces that he doesn't know how to use the internet. He refuses to learn to use the internet. Whenever anyone tries to teach him to use it, he listens politely and then immediately tries to forget. It's just like his one sort of, I put my foot down somewhere. He uses email, he uses a word processor, but if he wants anything off the internet, he just asks someone else. He just won't do it. You know, he's not going to come that far into modern times. It's just a quirk of his nature. But when I was, let's see, where was I? Let me just find my thought with it. Oh, yes. Because even though we live in this enormous city area and I'm by no means sequestered, nonetheless, you know, we don't choose to go to a lot of things and functions where people go, where people drink, where people carouse and just do things that others would consider perfectly natural because it's not inspiring. But every so often, if you're very far away from those energies and you see people, you know, trying to have a good time by being loud and outward and punching each other and drinking a lot of beers and just becoming more and more, the only word you can use for it is frenzied. You can just feel, you know, what a fragile hold that behavior has on happiness. It's just, it's very good for the yogi to observe it, not to mix with it, believe me, because we all have samskaras we don't want to reawaken. You can just reawaken those samskaras so easily. When I was visiting my aunt and uncle, which I missed a class because I was helping them, I was just completely immersed in a completely other scene, and it was just so easy for me to see how easy it would be to just stop meditating, stop being a devotee, you know, just fall right into that world. It was so self-consistent. You know, devotee beware, Maya is very, very strong. But anyway, you observe that, and then you understand what they're talking about here. They're talking about these polarities that are always moving us. Oh, I got the promotion. Everybody at work really likes me. You know, the one I really didn't like, I really got one up on her, and now she's gone, and now I've got this position, and I'm going to hold this position. And then next week, the company is sold, and you have a new vice president who hates you, and all of a sudden, you're the one who's out. And there's just this up and down and up and down. And it's so exhausting, is really at the very end of it, you're just so exhausted. And people become so cynical because they see that nothing ever lasts. So what the yogi is striving to do is simply to turn the searchlight of happiness, or to look for happiness, real happiness, not passive blankness or just a kind of dull-mindedness that can't really be hurt or elated anymore. That's what you see in a lot of people. Well, did you have a good time? Yeah. You know, how was work? Oh, same as always. You know, just like whatever it is, it's like it's just too dangerous and too much effort to really become engaged in anything. So there's a certain equanimity, but it's the equanimity of reduced consciousness, not the equanimity of transcendence. You see what an enormous difference it is? And sometimes yogis, we don't have a lot of this within our community now, because we've all matured and there's enough mature examples around. But in the early years of our community, when we were all just starting out, and Swami was letting the cycle run before he was moving in gradually to really teach us, there was a lot more what we later called play acting at being a devotee. And you know, there was one woman in particular I remembered. She always wore white. She always carried a copy of Whispers from Eternity, which she would hold to her heart a great deal of the time. She was a very attractive woman. She had this long hair, and you would often see her standing, sort of like that. And when things would happen that were a little shocking, she would look to the ground when anyone was just too outward, and then you would see her quietly sort of turning the pages of her book. Now, you know, I was so enthusiastic, you know, that I just found her unspeakably boring. I could hardly bear it. You know, she was just so dull. And, you know, I didn't want to be judgmental, but I thought she was a fake, which in fact she turned out to be. I mean, she was sincere, but she wasn't really, she just thought that's how you were supposed to behave. And it was the whole, there was another woman who wasn't quite as bad, but she was close. She suppressed so much of her natural energy that she had completely flipped out at one point. Just really had a really dramatic breakdown. You know, what I don't mean to be light about these things, but somehow in my life I've had a lot of associations with people who are not mentally normal, and it's just sort of one of those things that happens. Sometimes people have nervous breakdowns and they get really strange for a while, and you all sort of run through it, and then they come out the other end. It's not a realm of life that is particularly freaky to me. I think I've been there really recently. I live right on the edge of it. But anyway, so she had this huge flip out and was incapacitated for quite some time, and then finally found her footing, and she never came back into the ashram, but she remained on the path. When she came back, she had gained weight. She was dressed in a very colorful sort of bohemian manner. She dyed her hair with this big streak. Her language was, she was very outspoken, even, I would say, raunchy in her personality. She was an absolute joy, where she had been, again, just sort of nobody in her idea of how I transcend. She, you know, it just didn't work, so she just became herself and was really far more genuinely spiritual with that energy than she had been when her entire focus was on you know, keeping the ego from expressing itself, which made her entire focus on the ego. And when she just simply relaxed and let it be itself, it became a far less dominating reality for her, even though the form of what she was doing looked less spiritual. In fact, it was more genuinely so because it was a real expression of her true nature. Plus, she wasn't so self-centered anymore. Now, this is the first time I've thought about it. What really bothered me about both women was they were so self-centered. That's what you could feel. You could feel this enormous self-concern. There was no self-forgetfulness in the persona. It was all self-concern. It's an ironic picture because one needs to be attentive to one's spiritual life. You can't be casual. You can't just go out and do anything and call it spiritual and think it's fine. You have to be attentive. But one mustn't allow one's concern about proper spiritual behavior and spiritual development to become so dominant that all one is thinking about is oneself. Self-forgetfulness is really the definition of expanded consciousness. Not any particular image of how it should look, but just forgetting the self in the contemplation and service of something much larger. Now, in these sections, when we're talking about this equanimity, it's because what we have penetrated through the disguise of Maya. And Maya is the garment that the Infinite Spirit dons in order to give us the impression that this world is a fragmented reality, that certain things are bad and certain things are good, and these things will help us and these things will hurt us, and all of the different images we get. Whereas the truth behind it is that there is one divine force which is acting through everything that we experience for one purpose, which is gradually to inspire us to forsake delusion, to forsake confusion and suffering, and to embrace infinite joy. And that is the simple mantra that we have to say over and over and over again. Everything that comes to me from God. This is why we cultivate with the deepest part of ourselves a devotional attitude toward life and toward the spiritual path. This is why we practice japa and the presence of Master, and why we constantly need to think about the Guru's presence within us. This is what Anna was talking about last week, I think, or I think it was in this class, but she was talking about just wanting always to be in Master's company and wanting to feel that whatever guise an event wears, what it really is Master's just coming to liberate you. Now, if everything that comes to you is actually a gift-wrapped blessing from Guru, why would you think that this is a stone and this is a bar of gold? Why would you think that this is a pleasure and that this is a pain? You know, this is something I desire, this is something I don't. What part of us makes all those distinctions? It's the part of us that has this thought that my happiness is dependent on all these circumstances. That's what the word pleasure or pain means. It means that this one brings me happiness and this one takes my happiness away. But whose happiness is it really taking? Where is that happiness that's being robbed? If our happiness is defined by sense experiences and the definition of the ego, then all those things have power over us. If our happiness is defined by the inner relationship we have formed through Kriya Yoga and meditation practices with this, and this is where all the aspects of the Gita, you see, come together. Before we were talking about drawing the energy to an inward focus in the spine, energizing the chakras, lifting the attention to the spiritual eye, releasing our awareness of the senses, focusing merely on the upward and downward flow of the energy, feeling the breath. You know, if we have defined ourselves as the upward and downward flowing inward currents activated by the breath, then we just become interested observers. Oh, look, we say about ourselves, she's being vilified. She's being sued. She's being evicted. You know, she's lost her job. She's hungry. She's fat. She's skinny. Oh, look, they think she's wonderful. They're all praising her. They're giving her awards. You know, it's like we're just breathing And then all of these things happen. And it's not, as Master emphasizes here, that you really, when a stone and a bar of gold are put in front of you, that you just can't tell which is which, or you can't tell when someone is being angry with you or loving to you. Of course you can tell. But what you do, and I love the way he puts it, to be spirituality doesn't make you stupid. You're not dumb. The yogi is not dumb. He just sees things as they are, but then defines his response to them from a completely different reality. Now that was, we've talked many times about the experience of Swami, the enormous attack on his character that was part of the cycle of lawsuits that we went through, and how he had to sit in a courtroom and have people just say really terrible things about him. And to make it even worse, because of the sanctions imposed on us by this judge, we weren't allowed to say anything positive in response. We were literally forbidden to present any defense to any charges of misconduct against Swami Kriyananda in regard to sexuality. We just couldn't say anything. And we couldn't even cross-examine the witnesses. I mean, it all sounds just preposterous, but that's actually what happened. And the jury was never informed that we were sanctioned. So the people could lie as much as they wanted to, because we could never cross-examine them, which they did. They perjured themselves gleefully. We all just had to sit through it and then go on. So there was never any balancing, ever, any balancing testimony or evidence presented, of which, of course, we had, you know, freight cars full of balancing testimony. So Swami just had to sit there and just listen to people talk about what a monstrous person he was. And, you know, just imagine it. It's easy to sort of say that you could do that, but it's quite something else to actually, I mean, think how much your feelings get hurt when somebody just accidentally says, you were so rude. Or even worse, when you overhear somebody saying, I don't know why she behaves like that, you know, just so upsetting to everyone. Just any of those things. You can say it doesn't bother you, but it goes like a knife. And Swami just had to sit there, just calmly listen. He just said, he just never felt they were talking about him. You know, it just wasn't him. And it didn't mean, it just wasn't, first of all, they were fabricating. But nonetheless, it just wasn't him. And even when people did say good things, which they got to occasionally, it wasn't him. Who am I? In the highest sense of the word. Who am I, really? Am I all these moving waves on the ocean? Or am I the vast ocean underneath? It's just, these are, everything in this section of the Gita was just so glorious to meditate on. They're just such beautiful meditations to just really sit there with the thoughts of just holding up all the opposites in front of you. And just really deeply just settling into each one. I've often tried to calm my fears by trying to, when, you know, everybody has mental techniques, whenever I face some difficulty, I often just imagine out the worst that's going to happen and then accept it. And then, of course, come back to try to prevent it. But having once accepted it, it takes a lot of tension out of the situation. I don't mean really life-threatening situations, but just what's the worst that can happen here? Many people do that. What's the worst that can happen? Okay, I could manage that. Then there's no tension as you work with it. But really taking that deeply, one of my friends had a deep fear of being expelled from Ananda based on perhaps Swamiji's past experience or her own experience. She's had this deep fear. She said for years, she said, she would often in meditation just try to walk herself through that potentiality, you know, and see how far she could get before her heart started racing and she couldn't even imagine it anymore. And gradually over time, she got herself so that she could go all the way to the end of it and feel free. And it's an exercise really worth doing. You don't have to wait till you're a Jivan Mukta and you're, you know, you envision doing all your karma. Just raise up those agitating realities to you. Hold up in front of you those deep disappointments, those longings that were never fulfilled, that sense of regret and personal failure. Just meditate on these verses of the Gita. A stone, a piece of gold, a relative, a well-wisher, a an enemy, a friend, and just find the reality, the part within yourself that is untouched by that. I know I've shared with you one of my earliest memories was being scolded by my mother as a child of two or something like that, and just curling up in the back seat of the car and internalizing my consciousness deeper and deeper until I found the place that wasn't affected by her scolding. And, you know, it's just yoga. That's all I was doing. It's the same method we all use now, isn't it? It was just a memory of past lives, like all of us, of having been yogis before. I feel I'm suffering. How do I deal with it? By finding the part of ourself that is the deep part of the ocean, so that, I can visualize my memory clearly. And it was just like that. I wouldn't have said wave on the ocean, but that was really it. I knew that the pain of being scolded was the wave on the ocean, and that there was a deep ocean that wasn't touched by those waves. Now that's what we're talking about here. That's what the Gita is talking about when it's talking about that sameness. And when you see it manifested, again, this is why the incarnated saints and masters are so vital, because otherwise the mind can just spin out and not get it. So we have to look at Master's life, and we have to look at Swami's life with this and see what even-mindedness actually looks like. For example, Swami tells the story in the path of when Master wanted to buy Mount Washington. And whatever it was, at $25,000, which seems like just a drop in the bucket, or whatever it was that it cost, some apparent pittance to Utch, which in that economy was still a very large sum of money. And someone said to him, oh, it's going to take you 3 years. He had 3 months. Master had 3 months to raise the money. And someone said, it's going to take you years to raise that money. He said, you know, 3 decades to those who think 3 decades, 3 years to those who think 3 years, and 3 months to those who think 3 months. And Master applied every ounce of his willpower to making sure that they got that. And he was working, as the story is told, right up to the last minute, trying to find the money and phoning people and visualizing and praying to the universe to bring him the money so he could buy Mount Washington. He was anything but blank or passive. Or, well, we'll get it or we won't, you know. It's just all the same. Our happiness doesn't depend on it. It was do or die for him, because we do have these divine assignments. But the equanimity is that his inner happiness was not touched by what happened. There's another story that's told in the path about they had this, at the Hollywood church, they have this wishing well. No, it's at Mount Washington. They have this wishing well. It's made out of concrete. And they tell the story of when it was brought there, was being moved, and somehow it slipped and it fell on Master's foot and just crushed his foot. And he did a demonstration for people. He said, now I will put my mind at the level of the body. And his face became just distorted with agony, and he couldn't put any weight on the foot, because that was the level on which there was pain and pleasure, and he was experiencing it. He said, now I will lift my mind to the superconsciousness. And he lifted his mind to a superconsciousness, and he just walked on the foot. I mean, it was just like even the whole body responded on a different level, depending on what level of consciousness he was in. And that's, again, that's not blankness. That's not dullness. That's taking all the energy that would normally be magnetized in a downward way into the spine, onto a lower level of consciousness, and just pulling it up so that there is no vortex on those levels of suffering. And then you just become so joyous about everything. Swami Kriyananda, sometimes people will say, you've worked so hard, you've done this, you've done that. Have I? He'll say. Just like, sometimes he'll say, well, I feel so tired. I don't know why I'm so tired. Well, Swamiji, you've been here 6 weeks. You've done 44 programs. You've written 3 books. You've done this. You just make this list of that. And just, that's a lot of work. Oh, maybe it is. It's sort of like, it never crosses his mind to characterize things one way or another. Even in the book I wrote about him, I mentioned the story of one man was with him in Europe, and they had dinner with this couple that was doing, they were involved in the publishing of Swami's books. So they were friends, but not devotees and not at all involved in our teaching. It was a business relationship, but nothing with Swamiji is entirely business. So they went out to dinner together, and afterwards, when the couple finally separated from them, Swami's companion said, "Oh, I'm so glad to get away from them. The negativity between them was so intense." And Swami said, "It was?" And his companion said, "Sir, didn't you notice?" And then he went on and enumerated all these, you know, biting interactions between them. I actually knew the couple, and I know just what he was talking about. I wasn't at dinner, but I had met them before. And then Swami thought for a moment. He said, "You know, when I look back on it," he said, "every single response to their conversation was to guide them toward a greater sense of acceptance and harmony." He said, "But I never allowed even the thought that their interaction was negative to enter my mind." You know, in other words, he just had, and I've observed this in Swami, he's just purged from his consciousness this thought of "I like, I don't like." It's just not there. Just things happen and he responds to them. You know, responding appropriately is what is how the Gita puts it, to react appropriately. And the only way that we can react appropriately is if we're calmly centered in ourself. Otherwise, we're just a puppet of unconsidered reactions. Isn't that true? Let's pause a moment. Do we have any other thoughts or comments on any of this? It's very, very important. I think I'll tell you what you've heard before, some of you, but sometimes when you're new on the path, you just say the damnedest things to people, thinking it'll be attractive to them. And when I was like 18, 19 years old, I thought this overcoming of desires was just really the way to pick it up. I don't know what on earth made me think that was attractive to people, but I was campaigning with all my friends and acquaintances that this is such a wonderful teaching because it teaches you to overcome your desires. And people would just look at me like, "Why would I want to do that?" And so one of my distant relatives, I was trying to win her to the cause by pointing out that isn't it so that when you desire something and you put all your happiness on it and then you finally get it and then it makes you happy for a while, in a very short time it just becomes ordinary? She was completely in agreement with me, but her philosophy was, that's why it's so important to keep on wanting new things. It was just how she'd solved it. You know, she'd seen this ever-disappointing nature of this world, but her idea was just to whip up more waves. We have to be very careful, even in our own nature, not to try to do that. It's better to whip up waves than to go to sleep, which is something that's taken me a while to understand. So for a lot of people, it's really, really important for them to marry and have big families and then to take care of their grandchildren, and because they need to keep giving. They need to have something to keep their energy up. It's not necessarily bad. And so do all of us. That's why having interests is really helpful. But we need to do them in such a way that we challenge ourselves on bigger and bigger levels to ride the waves with a calm inner understanding of what the real truth of our nature is. Does that work? You understand that? Why don't we take a little short break? It's a little bit early, but let's do that. You know, the words of the Gita itself are so marvelous. When I was reading through again, I was coming up with this. The Gita stanza itself says, as a condition for meditating, you know, you'll be able to meditate when you're free from the hope created by desire. I mean, that's not the hope of salvation, but that's the expectation that certain of your desires will be fulfilled. When you're free from the craving for possessions or for possession of anything, possession even of your own name, your own body, you know, that's a possession of anything, because nothing in this world can really be possessed. What can you hold on to? Think about it. It's Master talks about how, you know, God laughs when you say, this is my land and this is your place and this is my home and this is, and then we just disappear from this planet and the planet just goes on, or the earthquake heaves or the ocean rolls over, and all that we've just possessed, this craving to possess, it's an aspect of consciousness. That's what the Gita is describing. These are verses that you can just sit and meditate on for a really long time. Hope created by desires. Not hope created, as I was saying, by gods, promise of immortality, but just by the desire to have something and the hope that it's going to come. That's what brings us back again and again. The process of reincarnation is the same as what disturbs us in meditation. You know, so often trying to give people the image of how it's like in the astral world, we come down here, I've shared with you just the playful images of what it's like when you're sitting home and you're going to have a quiet evening at home, and then the thought of pizza takes you out. And you're driving to get the pizza and you run into a friend who suggests a movie, and then afterwards you go out for a cup of coffee, and then suddenly your whole peaceful night has just been used up in another way because some restlessness just came in. And how we're in the astral world, and then just some restlessness comes in and we lose our focus, and all of a sudden we're incarnating again. We may do it consciously. We may consciously incarnate, or else we may just be sucked down by our desires. Just what I was saying at the beginning, the mind goes blank, and all of a sudden here we are again. Master said the baby cries because it realizes that it's taken human form again. He said that's why it cries. It cries because it's, I'm breathing in, I'm in a physical body, my whole consciousness is now limited by this body. Oh no! And he actually says that the astrological moment of birth is the first breath. I mean, not necessarily a cry, but the first breath. And some babies are born very calmly. You know, some babies don't cry. They just, there they are. Here we are again. Or they don't cry much. They've accepted it. They're coming. Craving for possession. And then he said, and waves of feeling in the heart, that those waves of feeling have been controlled. Now understand the word feeling in this is waves of likes and dislikes is what he's talking about, not divine longing. But just in that condition, then you can go away and meditate. And also what Krishna is saying is when you have achieved that state, you don't need to interact with the world anymore. And therefore you can just withdraw from the world. For the rest of us, because we have these waves of desire and these waves of wanting to possess and all the things, these things, we have to keep interacting with those realities so that we can learn what they have to teach us. I mean, how is it that we learn not to have those feelings? Because we keep experiencing them and we understand what they are. We overreact and we see the difficulty that it causes us. We fix our minds on some unattainable desire and it never comes to us and we suffer. Or we fix our minds on some attainable desire and we get it. And then it just doesn't give us what we expected to give us. I recall when we totally revised the program guide, one of the many times that we've done it, maybe 10 years ago or so, and we hired this really superb designer and I worked with him for weeks and we just put out this, it was so beautiful, I was looking at it recently, just beautifully designed, beautifully conceived. And when it came, I was so excited about it. And I looked at every picture, I read every word, and then I closed it and I started it again, and then I put it down for a while, then I picked it up, and finally I said out loud to David, I think this thing has given me just about as much happiness as it's ever going to give me. You know? And I just put it down for the final time. Just let's consciously act it out. You know, we have these desires, let's just live through and really act in this world in such a way that the ego is transcended instead of strengthened. And just contemplate. Instead of just letting these things run and then letting ourselves fall into the psychological model of why can't I get these things and I'm worthy, I deserve it, this is what I want. Ask what it would feel like to be freed from the craving to possess. What would it really feel like? Or the hope that this desire will be fulfilled. Master talks in here about the extreme benefit, even for those of us who must live in the world, of periods of withdrawal, where we really live in silence and we really live in solitude. And you know, the Ananda practice has often been to take a week or 2 weeks a year, one day a week, half a day. It's not, some of us are better and worse than following this, but it's a very good practice to just completely separate yourself from your normal reality and be quiet and devote time to spirituality. It just changes everything. You know, the deeper we can be inside ourselves, the more everything in life is different. It's one of the many reasons why, with all that we're doing to revitalize things, I would really love to get a solid core of group meditation going in the community. It's just tragic that we don't do that. It's tragic because we are living in such an extraordinary opportunity. And yes, I know meditation is a positive solitary pursuit, but really, in the parts of Ananda where they have a strong group sadhana 4 or 5 days a week, it's just no substitute for it. It's so powerful. And we live with that potential all around us, and we don't do it. I've been 40 years in Ananda, though, and I know that you can never talk anybody into it. The village, after all these years, now has this extraordinary community satsang, community meditation going from 6:30 to 8, you know, every day of the week, or 5 or 6 days of the week. When once you start, it's like, you know, you just jump out of bed and run over there to meditate. They have it in India. It's so phenomenal. You just can't wait for the morning to come to run and meditate, and it just anchors you. And we have that potential power. Just for some inexplicable reason, which is, I mean, the village is 40 years old, and they have just for the first time ever gotten a solid community daily meditation going. So I recognize that there's some force of Maya. I'm going to tell you a ridiculous joke. We were having our photograph taken, and Karen was trying to help David and I relax by reading us jokes. She had some really good one. Let's see. It's a good thing that the earth sucks. Otherwise, we'd all fall off. Isn't that the most ridiculous thing? I don't know why I said that. I don't know what it related to, but it's great. Okay, I'm just going to go on. Then Swami's, you know, he's going through that whole section of the Gita where it talks about kusha grass and the deer. It's so exact. Make the kusha grass, then put the animal skin, then put silk or wool on top of it. And all of a sudden you also stop and think, boy, that must be really important. I mean, it's right there in the Gita. It's so extremely specific. But then Swami also interprets it. Master interpreted it. It's the earth, the water, and the fire elements. It's talking about you must firmly insulate yourself or settle yourself. The lower three chakras must be planted firmly and protected, and then you can build on that, the upper reality. Even just the fact of sitting, you know, you however you sit, you know, this is the bending point, and then the upper chakras are there. Everything else is settled down. It's very powerful, but you know, there's people, and it's the Hare Krishna movement has argued, I don't know if they're so fanatical now, but they used to be, that because there's no kusha grass in America, Westerners can't meditate, because you have to meditate. That's what he touches that in here. You don't even know what he's answering. Well, some people have said, but it's true. It was because they just said that chanting was the only reality, and we weren't supposed to meditate because there was no kusha grass in the West. But there's places in the Gita where Krishna is very exact about things. He mentions names or specific elements, and this is one of them, but it has that esoteric significance. But nonetheless, I love Swami talking about a deer skin creates peace in your meditation, a tiger skin creates willpower, but you shouldn't really sit on a tiger skin unless you're sexually abstinent, because it can be unsettling because of the energy that it generates. I just was reading all that and I thought, boy, we just walk around this world like blind people. You know, there's so much subtlety going on. The skin of a dead animal, it also takes a lot of your sentimental thoughts. Here we are, you know, vegetarians and peaceful people. You're supposed to use an animal. I loved how Swami put it to you. You're supposed to use an animal that's died of natural causes. But Master's tiger skin had a clear bullet hole in it, you know, and still Master used it. And you know, there's pictures of him meditating on that tiger skin. But you, part of you would think, why would you even want to sit on a dead animal skin? But then on the other hand, there it is in the Gita, that there's some, you know, there's some beneficial relationships in all of these things that are not about just being sentimental. Things die. There's an extraordinary story told about Master of him and Oliver Black. and go, and this must have just been a lesson for Oliver Black. In some reason, he was a very advanced disciple. Walking around outside, and there was a line of ants across the sidewalk, and Master took the trouble to stomp on the whole line of ants and kill them. I mean, mostly you think of, you know, being careful of living things, this enormous respect, and he just stomped out the whole line of ants and then looked at Oliver, and he said, "Oliver, it was their time to go." Just like that. Like, why be so sentimental about death? Like, what is this great squeamishness that all creatures should just stay in their bodies? I've contemplated that a lot. You know, why is it that we react? Oh, so-and-so died. Everybody dies. Why is it a cause for comment? There is, it is true, and this is valid, especially a human body. You know, there's a tremendous spiritual potential in a human body, and it is not something to be cast aside lightly, and it takes a long time to get one and get it trained and have it begin to function for you in a way that can move you towards spirit. And so you don't want to just shed it prematurely because you're just going to have to go to all the trouble to get another one. And that was when Happy Winningham asked Swamiji how long she should struggle to stay in her body. She had AIDS. And you know, the cures and the sustaining her life in that body took a tremendous amount of her time and effort, and she didn't always feel that great. When should I just give up? She said to Swamiji, "I've had death and return experiences. I'm not the least afraid of dying." And that was when he answered, just so practically, this is also in the book. He said, "You're just going to have to come back and be a child again, and you'll have to spend all those years of infancy and childhood and through adolescence to get yourself organized and find your spiritual path and learn Kriya again." He says, right now you have Kriya, and you're in your spiritual family, and you've passed through all those stages. He said, you don't want to just throw that away. But then he answered her so perfectly. He said, if the body becomes an insurmountable obstacle to God remembrance, if you simply cannot do Kriya through it anymore and you cannot even use it to remember the presence of God, then shed it. Then just let it go. Because then it's no friend to you anymore and you just need to start over. Isn't that interesting? So there is that. And everything is evolving to us on a certain level. But also, you know, the masters just stand back. That's what Krishna says right at the very beginning of this. Arjuna had all this squeamishness about battle. Krishna had none. Because death, life, it's all just this flow. Swami told us about this Italian woman saint. She was a very peculiar woman and lived as a servant in someone else's home. And she was so far-sighted that she saw disincarnated souls without bodies, and she couldn't really tell who was alive and who was dead, basically. And she would sometimes have to ask them whether they were alive or dead, or find out from others how many living people there were in the room so she'd know how to set the table. Because it was all the same to her. Isn't it just so fascinating? And just all this business about the tiger and the deer skin, that's why there's so many aspects of this Gita that you can just stare at the paragraph. There's the esoteric, that Swami, the symbolic about the chakras, and then there's just the mere fact of the interweaving, and why would a tiger have that particular power? Why a tiger? Why not a lion? Why not an elephant? Why, you know, just like, what is the consciousness of a tiger that his vibration is still in the skin? That it increases your willpower even though the animal is gone? Amazing, isn't it? Just absolutely amazing. And then there was another Gita verse here, which it just speaks of neither roaming mentally nor reacting to sense stimuli. Sit in silence and seek self-purification. Isn't that an interesting phrase? I was thinking about how Swamiji created that ceremony, which he called the purification ceremony, which he said often refers to as one of the most important things that we do, both for the actual transference of energy and also for the inner symbology of what we're doing. You know, so much of repeating ceremony, you have to be very careful that it doesn't just become repeating ceremony. And here in the Gita, it says, In other words, don't with your concentration absolutely fixed, divorced from the external distractions of acting through your body, seek to purify your inner self. Well, what would that possibly mean? It would mean to resolve seeds of karma. It would mean to transcend the levels of desire. It would be to work out through vision or everything else. The way Swami talks about it in the purification ceremony, and the reason he uses that word is, when you purify something, you restore it, its inherent nature, by taking away from it everything that has intruded upon that. And that's how we describe our spiritual path. It's so easy to think that spiritual realization is something that we acquire, something that I lack and therefore I gain. But the reality of it is, it's something I have completely that is simply obscured. And it's obscured by the opposite of neither roaming mentally nor allowing yourself to be distracted by the senses. It's obscured by this mistaken idea that because our senses are the avenue through which we should experience and all of the dualities that takes us into. We purify ourselves from wrong desires. We purify ourselves from wrong habits. We purify ourselves from fears and misunderstandings. And that's how meditation, that's why people say, you don't really have to worry about anything, just meditate. Especially if you do Kriya, especially if we do Kriya, you meditate according to the instructions that our Guru has given us. That's one of the lines in one of the verses here, right close to this one. Do the techniques according to what your Guru has given you. Well, what our Guru has given us is the absolute core action for self-purification, because it's lifting the energy through the chakras and turning those vortices of materialistic attachment and ambition and simply dissolving them and drawing them up the spine. That's what Kriya does. Kriya, the energy up and down the spine, the higher Kriya is concentrating on the chakras, doing the mantras in the chakras. Almost all of you know the details of this. It's exactly this. It's self-purification in its most irrefutable, powerful, and internal form. It's really hard sometimes for us even to imagine what we really have in this, because everything that causes us grief is a vritti in one of the chakras that draws our energy away from one point of concentration. I mean, the whole Gita is telling you to bring it back to an inward focus, and our life experience is that it keeps getting sucked out. And it keeps getting sucked out because there are these vrittis, whirlpools of energy, with some little core desire held in place by the ego, and that obscures our divine nature. So we sit on the kusha grass, on the deer skin, we sit on the powers that insulate us from our downward moving energy, and we do the practices our guru taught us, and what we gradually create is self-purification. And once that's done, you see, once that vritti is dissolved, it's over, the wave is passed. I love what Master said, the only difference between a saint and a sinner is how they behave. And that just sounds so funny on one hand, but in other words, there's nothing and no one is inherently anything. We are all divine. We just gradually cease to be compelled by the vrittis in our chakras. We no longer have the hope of desires fulfilled. We no longer have the craving for possessions. We no longer have the conflicting feelings of the heart. You know, we no longer allow our mind to roam. We no longer give in to the stimulation of the senses. We've purified ourselves of all those realities. You know, it's very magnificent just to contemplate this. I mean, many of us are more engaged in outward service. We just don't have the karma to have long hours and weeks of secluded meditation. But when we do meditate, if we can keep dynamically and clearly in mind what we're actually doing, you know, and cooperate with that process, even when the mind wanders, to offer back into the light. I know that I was saying to some of you not too long ago, I was able to unravel a really compelling and unfortunate bit of karma within myself by the realization finally that it didn't exist except as a vritti in my chakras, that it had no reality except it was just a little whirling piece of energy. And just by then just doing kriyas to counteract that energy very consciously, I'm not free, that would be to speak much too grandly, but its grip has certainly diminished. And it was when it just suddenly came under my control. You know, all this time I've been working with past life memories and this inclination and that insecurity and this and all those things, which are all true. But finally I had to realize, but all of that just comes down to a vritti in the chakras, which is susceptible to dissolution through kriya. You just sit and meditate according to the techniques your guru taught you, holding yourself as one-pointed as you can, and concentrate on self-purification. And I was speaking of the purification ceremony, that's adding the grace of the guru into it. You know, I seek purification by the grace of God. What are you declaring? One recognizes that, yes, self-effort's going to get me somewhere, but I also really have to open myself to a power greater than I am, because, you know, the more intently I work on all shifting all these vrittis, the more self-concerned I become. There needs to be some force that moves through me. The master says, we reply, open your heart to me, because it's the heart, you see, where the vrittis reside. This is where the conflicting waves of feeling. Open your heart to me, and I will enter and take charge of your life. I was reading in the SRF magazine this month. There's an article. I don't know if you can read that magazine online. For some reason, we just have this never-ending subscription, which I like getting it because it's a very interesting article. And Master talks about how every aspect of your physical body has some symbolic reality. And he was talking about the heart and feeling and how the heart is associated with love. I can't say it as clearly as he said it. But he was just emphasizing again that the physical heart is really he was talking about how everything depends on the beating of the heart. As soon as this heart stops beating, it's over. You know, no amount of vitamins and organic food is ever going to just revitalize that. It's always, the heart is the center point from which everything emanates. And the heart chakra is where the bondage to likes and dislikes and also the freedom from that can also be attained. Open your heart to me, Master said, and I will enter and I'll take charge of your reality. That's the purification, is that instead of thinking, I'm going to be in charge, we recognize that he's in charge. Somebody asked me a question a couple of days ago too, which was a really interesting one, which I'll share and then I'll call it a night. He asked me the question, I was trying to think about whether to take discipleship initiation, and he asked me a very valid question, why would I surrender to my will to someone else? Shouldn't I, you know, isn't it more appropriate to be in charge of my own destiny? So I stopped and thought about that for a bit, and then I answered back by saying, you know, we live in a world in which we have a sense of our own individuality. And it's very difficult to understand things unless they're brought to some kind of a clear focus. You know, we understand love because we love people, we love animals, we love art, we love something. And that gives us an experience of loving. It's very hard to just understand love with no object. Eventually, we can understand love with no object, but in the meantime, we learn about love by having it personified. Hatred, the same. Everything has some form. So the master's understanding this will incarnate in a physical body to be able to manifest to us in a specific way that we can relate to that there's a point for our devotion and an example of what it means to be a devotee. Many things that are taught. But merely because that form has a name, Paramhansa Yogananda, and a face and a personality and a certain destiny that we witness, doesn't mean that what we're actually witness is in any way defined by the container that it comes to us in. That it is really, literally, the infinite consciousness that is just shining through this small window. Now, that infinite consciousness, which Master is the same reality that dwells within us. The only reason that it appears to be something else is because we're deeply identified with our body and we perceive Yogananda and define him through the body he inhabits. But the super consciousness that he is our super consciousness. It's not merely that Master is aware of us. This is how Swami says it all the time. He is us. Because on that infinite level, it all comes together. So what we're trying to surrender when we say we're surrendering our will to the guru is we're taking our commitment to acting according to the ego and we're actually saying, I want to be guided by super consciousness. But the super consciousness that's guiding us is not separate from ourselves, because once Master has attained that state of realization, once I've attained that state of realization, it's the same. But it's very difficult for us to grasp that actually without having some personification of it so we can understand how it really acts itself out in the same way that we understand all the others. So it appears to us that that guidance is coming through this form. We feel it when we meditate. We magnetize it by looking at his eyes, by praying to him. But the guidance that actually is coming to us is our own super consciousness telling us what to do. Isn't that a wonderful way to look at it? I just loved that. I thought it was just so beautifully helpful. I don't think I can go anywhere beyond that. So, thank you all very much. Good night. Bless you.